Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
The T-Biz podcast delivers T-news that you need to know. A recap of the week's major headlines with commentary and cultural trends hosted by Dan Bolton. It is the voice of origin for tea professionals and enthusiasts worldwide.
Tea nourishes and inspires. It is an ancient plant-based medicine that simultaneously heals and energizes the body as it soothes the mind. Making fine tea is a blend of artistry and craftsmanship. The $200 billion tea trade is fundamentally local, yet exerts global influence, employing millions to enhance the well-being of all. Hello, everyone. Here are this week's headlines. Predictions for a hot spring follow an extremely hot winter. The Chinese celebrated virtual Qingming last week. And a swish of black tea kills 99.9% of COVID-19 in saliva. Plus, Beyond Matcha. Matcha, a shining success story that revived the Japanese tea industry, also paved the way for enthusiasts interested in other Japanese teas, such as hojicha, a light brown-colored green tea roasted in porcelain pots over charcoal. Noli Urgis, senior account manager in the Seattle office of Tsujimoto Tea, joins us this week to explain how matcha's success instills hope for the future of the Japanese tea industry, especially among younger consumers who prefer sweeter, less bitter teas to the traditional grassiness of Japanese greens. More in a minute, but first, this important message.
What makes a perfect cup of Ceylon tea? The perfect cup is from the tea businesses that ensure the protection of all the children living within their tea estates. We salute Keilani Valley, Talawakili, Bogawanthalawa, Harana, and Eliptia tea estates. Support Save the Children Sri Lanka.
Spring sprung weeks ahead of schedule as global temperatures reached a record, stressing tea plants in both hemispheres. March was the 10th consecutive month of record high temperatures, overshooting the 1.5 degrees Celsius global target for the entire year. Temperatures during the past 12 months were 1.58 C above pre-industrial averages. The EU's Copernicus Climate Change Service recorded temperatures globally as 1.68 degrees C, that's 3 degrees Fahrenheit, hotter than historical averages last month. Spring arrived after the hottest winter on record in the U.S. According to NOAA, the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the global land and surface temperatures in March were 45.1 degrees Fahrenheit, that's 3.6 degrees above the 20th century average. February was 1.4 degrees C, which is 2.52 degrees F above the 20th century average of 12.1 degrees C and 53.8 degrees Fahrenheit. Copernicus Deputy Director Samantha Burgess told Bloomberg News that, quote, "Stopping further warming requires rapid reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. Policymakers and scientists warn that exceeding the 1.5 C limit could threaten life on the planet. Assam started the year bone dry, but the rains now arriving will revive the tea. In January, China experienced a cold wave that brought snow to many southern tea-growing regions. In Kenya, temperatures in the highlands east of the Rift Valley rose to 38 C in February, forecasts are for higher heat stress in eastern Kenya and Tanzania through May. Kenya experienced a wet year in 2023. Dry weather in the southern hemisphere is attributed to El Nino. The journal Scientific Reports predicts a 90% chance that global average surface temperatures will reach record highs by the end of June, easing as the La Nina cycle begins in the second half of 2024. The World Meteorological Organization said that El Nino would, quote, push global temperatures into uncharted territory along with climate change, end quote. Temperatures are now unofficially thought to be the hottest in at least 100,000 years. Business Insight. Extreme drought, a direct consequence of climate change, has become a recurring nightmare for tea plantations. It has struck with alarming frequency in recent years, leading to significant yield losses. A stark example of this is seen in China, where tea yields plummeted by a staggering 30% in 2023. One source of relief investigated by Chinese researchers is tea itself. Adding a concentrated mix of 100 milligrams of tea polyphenols per liter of water to soak roots under drought conditions promotes the closure of stomata, which greatly reduces water loss from the leaves. The polyphenols accumulate in the root system, significantly increasing EGCG, ECG, and EGC levels that enhance the plant's drought resistance through multiple pathways, according to the study published in the Journal of Molecular Sciences. Qingming, the three-day festival honoring ancestors and marking the beginning of the tea harvest, drew large crowds in fair weather this week. The tomb-sweeping festival encouraged families to unite and pay tribute to their deceased kin between March 26th and April 17th. The Day of Remembrance is the 15th day after the spring equinox, which is April 5th. Families dress in bright colors, bring flowers, and tidy up grave sites before enjoying the sun and snacks. Offerings typically include traditional food dishes and the burning of joss sticks, incense paper, currency, and paper replicas of items such as mansions, cars, and luxury bags for their ancestors to use in the afterlife. Virtual memorials, a modern adaptation of traditional practices, gained significant popularity during the COVID-19 pandemic. Gurinju, a virtual memorial platform created by Hubei programmer Wu Binyang to honor his late father, has amassed a user base of 650,000, with 85% of the registrations occurring between 2020 and 2023. Pre-Qingming teas, also known as Ming Queen teas, sell at a premium price. Longjing Dragon Well is a benchmark. Various grades of Shifen Longjing are currently advertised for between 825 and 1,025 for 250 grams. Tea harvested within Hangzhou's Westlake Scenic Area is generally pre-ordered and sold out long before retailers can offer it online. Teas grown in the Qiantang sector this year were the first Dragon Well harvested in 2024. Other popular teas include a 500-gram pouch of Mingqian Anji Bai Cha that sells for $500 online, and a first pluck Bai Lo Chun green tea priced at $2 per gram. Yunnan is China's largest tea-producing province with an annual output of 500,000 metric tons of raw leaf grown on 1.2 million acres. Tea has been cultivated there since the Eastern Han Dynasty from AD 25 to 220. Banna, Simao, Lingkang, and Baoshan are the most productive regions. An estimated 54 million tea trees over 100 years old are growing in Yunnan's tea forest. Business Insight. In 2023, the Yunnan government launched an online streaming sales platform, The live stream earned 17 million won during its first 6 months. According to live stream manager Duan Ming-chun, each four-hour streaming session generates an average of 500,000 won. That's about 70,000 in U.S. dollars. Researchers at the University of Georgia report that 10 seconds of contact with black tea kills 99.9% of COVID-19 in saliva. Typical concentrations of commercially available green tea, mint medley, eucalyptus mint, and raspberry zinger teas were nearly as lethal to the SARS-CoV virus in vitro. Virologist Malak Esseli and co-author Juliana N. Morris at the University of Georgia Center for Food Safety in the College of Agriculture and Environmental Sciences published their findings in the January issue of the peer-reviewed journal Food and Environmental Virology. Curious about the widespread use of tea to treat respiratory ailments, Dr. Esseli purchased 5 grocery store teas and brewed infusions at 2 concentrations. 4 teas showed preventable effects ranging from 68 to 90% reduction of the virus at the lower drinkable concentration. She said the greatest preventative benefit was found immediately after mixing black tea with the live virus for 10 and 60 seconds. 10 seconds was sufficient at concentrations of 40 milligrams per milliliter. The drinkable teas were brewed for 10 minutes at 37 degrees Celsius. The tea for use as a gargle was brewed 4 times greater concentrations than the drinkable infusion. All 5 varieties reduced the virus by 99.9% within 10 seconds when administered as a gargle. The concentration of tea polyphenols measured against infectivity, quote, showed a significant correlation in virus reduction, end quote, she said. According to Esseli, the most potent effect was observed when the teas were introduced at the time of viral infection, suggesting a potential rapid at-home intervention such as tea drinking or gargling, quote, this could significantly reduce the infectious SARS-CoV load in the oral cavity, potentially mitigating infection of the oral mucosa, she said. Quote, inactivating SARS-CoV-2 in the mouth and the throat matters because that potentially reduces the introduction of the virus to the lower respiratory system, end quote, she said. Having something accessible, easily prepared, and suitable for all the family is the ideal. Clinical trials will be needed to demonstrate whether tea can benefit a patient ill with COVID-19, said Esseli, who adds that, quote, initial results are both promising and exciting for those looking to supplement medical care, end quote. And now, a word from our sponsor.
Hi, I'm Nish. I grew up in an organic tea farm and founded Nepal Tea Collective in 2016. Tea is not just a beverage for me, but a catalyst for social change, sustainably empowering hardworking artisans like my parents for the past 30 years. I'm on a mission to make the whole world aware of the goodness of Nepali teas and the good that comes from supporting growers in this remarkable land. If you haven't tasted Nepali teas yet, you're missing out. Our award-winning teas are making headlines. Find out why. Visit Nepal Tea Collective's website to get a free sample of this extraordinary taste of the Himalayas. That's nepalteacollective.com. Or just send me an email at nish, N-I-S-H, at nepalteacollective.com. Cheers.
Beyond Matcha. Matcha, a shining success story that revived the Japanese tea industry, also paved the way for enthusiasts interested in other Japanese teas, such as hojicha, a light brown-colored green tea roasted in porcelain pots over charcoal. Noli Urgest, senior account manager in the Seattle office of Tsujimoto Tea, joins us this week to explain how Matcha's success instills hope for the future of the Japanese tea industry, especially among younger consumers who prefer sweeter, less bitter teas to the traditional grassiness of Japanese greens. Texas native Noli Ergus discovered green tea in his teens. Researching and refining his palate from Arizona RTD convenience store cans to exquisite artisan works of art. After he moved to Japan, his professional journey in tea unfolded with the successful completion of the intense training required of a certified Japanese tea advisor. Noli, thanks a million for coming on the Tea Biz podcast. It's a joy to have you here talking tea.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. Yeah, excited to be talking with someone who's been reporting on tea for probably since I was in grade school. So, yeah, very happy to be here.
What brought you to tea?
I grew up in Texas, so Southern sweet tea was something that I enjoyed. When I was in high school is when RTD became prominent in the U.S., so when Arizona green tea came on the market, that was my first exposure to green tea. Someone in high school told me that, oh, white tea and green tea and black tea are all from the same plant. And that was just like, you know, mind-blown moment. Yeah, and then fast forward, I moved to Japan, lived in Japan, and worked as a school teacher in the public schools. There would be tea served to you once in the morning and once after lunch. And so I just got this green tea put in front of me, not knowing what it was, but unsweetened and very green. And so I got accustomed to drinking that every day. Coming back from Japan, living in the U.S., I started to miss that a little bit and started seeking tea on my own. In 2013, I returned from living in Japan for the last time. That was the third of three different times living there. I just wanted to work with a Japanese company to use my Japanese language and cultural knowledge. And it happened that Sugimoto Tea Company was hiring. And I come from an academic background. I was on track to be a PhD in paleontology before I shifted gears and went the way of the East. When I started, there was not much business-wise for Sugimoto in the U.S. So I had a lot of time to do research. And then my boss, Kyohei Sugimoto, he recommended, or at least threw it out there, that I could, if I was interested, pursue getting the Japanese Tea Advisor certification from the Japanese Tea Instructors Association, which I have come to find is, now being in the tea industry many years, is one of the most rigorous tea certifications you can possibly get. I didn't realize at the time, because I wasn't familiar with tea certifications, but that was a very rigorous and great introduction into what it takes to actually cultivate tea and process tea, at least in the Japanese style.
Japanese growers deliver precise amounts of uniformly processed intermediary leaves that are finished by processing specialists using different techniques and styles. In most instances, they've created a distinctive process that manifests as a brand. The Arracha, sold at auction, might end up being blended into 15 brands.
I actually like the term that you're using, two-tier production. It's actually not something that I was familiar with, but I think it explains the Japanese production pretty well. Greatly simplified, what this means is that unlike some origins where a certain person or family may grow the tea, harvest it, process it, and then send out a finished product that is from that one growing estate. In Japan, it's most common that a farm will grow the tea and then do the initial processing that must be done to make it a green tea, which is that kill green phase, which is achieved by steaming. And then critical to most Japanese tea is that there needs to be rolling while drying. And that will produce something called Arracha, which translates as crude tea. And then this gets traded. And a tea maker, like I work with Sugimoto Tea Company, or in Japan, Sugimoto Seicha, which literally translates as Sugimoto Tea Makers, a company like ours will then buy this crude tea, which is not ready for the market. It's too high a moisture content. It's unsorted. It's unfinished. The shelf life would be too low before, you know, it starts going bad. So we take that tea and then we blend with Aracha, or this crude tea from other farms, and then do additional processing, which includes things like sorting and further application of heat and the blending, of course. And then we come up with a finished product that should be consistent over the years. And not only do we come up with a finished product, generally it's going to be sencha if you're taking Aracha that's been rolled while drying. But from the same Aracha, the same crude tea, we can make sencha, we can make kukicha, genmaicha, hojicha, konacha, and some other ancillary tea types. So what the farmer provides is just one thing, this Aracha. And then what we finally create is many different finished teas. Now that's the sencha system. For matcha, it's a bit different in that it's crucial that the tea leaves, once steamed, are not rolled while drying. So they will be more blow dried and then like convection oven baked. And then that's when you have the tencha aracha, tencha being the loose leaf precursor to matcha. And that's something that we will then purchase and blend and further refine to remove the stems and the leaf veins. And then we chop, blend, and mill into matcha in the end. So that's the hopefully pretty simplified two-tier production system. In reality, usually in between the farm and the tea maker is the government auction house, which is what most tea makers participate in, where all the farmers take their tea leaves to market, and a representative from the tea maker will then bid on which lots they want. That's something that we have sidestepped many decades ago and worked directly with the farms.
What are the advantages of buying directly from tea farms?
Well, in Japan, it's, for one, massive tea estates are basically non-existent. So Japan is a lot more cut up. Farmers' fields may be completely geographically isolated from each other, where they drive to one field and they have to drive to another field because it's a country with a very long history and the whole layout of the land is rather patchwork at this point in terms of property ownership. So it's kind of tricky to talk about estates. I mean, it's basically whatever land that a certain farmer either owns or is leasing to grow the tea. And it does happen that there are folks who maybe have some plots of tea, but then they also have plots of potatoes and they have plots of rice. So something that our company leadership decided a little over a decade ago is that we really wanted to focus on organic matcha production. I think that was a keen insight that either my boss and or his father had at the time, because it really was the bulk of the demand in the US market and in the European market. So now we work with five different farms and farming cooperatives that we source our Aracha Tencha from, and then we blend as necessary. Currently, we have five grades of organic matcha. And then for conventional or non-organic matcha, we have a lot more.
At the beginning of the 20th century, Japan was an export powerhouse, supplying most of the world's green tea. However, from the 1950s to the 1970s, Japan exported little or no tea. The domestic market consumed the entire harvest. Tea imports grew to 9 million kilos in 1974. There were 53,687 commercial tea farms in the year 2000. Domestic tea production peaked at 100 million kilos in 2004 and has gradually declined since. There are fewer than 20,000 farms today, while tea exports are at record highs.
Let me give a brief arc of the trade of tea outside of Japan, because it does give it is, I think, very helpful in painting the picture of where the Japanese tea industry is now. Well, pre-1853, Japan was growing its own tea. It was consuming its own tea. There was not, it basically had only established trade with the Portuguese and a little bit with the Dutch. And in 1853 is when Matthew Perry of the U.S. Navy marched into Japan, well, sailed into Japan and basically demanded that Japan start opening with trade to other Western countries, namely the U.S. And Japan slowly, but by 1868, really was just all out producing tea for export to the U.S. And that was basically to please the palates of largely Midwesterners, people in the West Coast and in the Midwest. The Chicago area, Wisconsin, Minnesota, all were very thirsty for Japanese green tea. And you actually had both Americans and Chinese who were running the factories to help make the Japanese tea to the U.S. palate's liking. And that continued basically just a lot of steam tea, of course, but pan-fired tea was also very regularly coming out of Japan at that time. And then black tea started being exported like 1870s. So, you know, the Japan export market was like, these are the teas for overseas. And then these other teas are what we're going to make to our liking. We're going to consume here. And that continued basically until, Japan kind of fell out of favor leading up to World War II. And, you know, the export market really took a major hit. Halted for a while and then was slow to recover afterwards. So after that, I mean, Japanese tea exports, particularly to the U.S., were kind of a trickle. And the Japanese were slowly seeking higher quality teas themselves because Japan was very much a peasant class, warrior class, ruling class kind of stratified society where the common people didn't get to drink nice teas like Sencha. So the 20th century was really the commoners of Japan catching up to that and getting to consume nicer and nicer teas through the years, culminating with the bubble economy of the 1980s, where people in Japan were spending lavishly. You know, if you wanted to drink the finest tea in the land, then you sought the finest tea in the land and you drank that. If you wanted a $300,000 stone for your garden, then you went and you bought that. Like, there was just money flying everywhere in Japan. In the tea industry, there was a saying that if you make tea, you make money. It was as simple as that. And that was when, adjusted for modern day values, that was the time when the average cost per kilo of Japanese tea was at its highest that it's ever been. And it's been a steady decline since then and more precipitous decline in the past couple of decades. So the Japanese tea industry has really been struggling as the Japanese economy has not really recovered fully from the bubble economy of the 80s, combined with now amongst younger Japanese people, you know, looking towards what your grandparents are doing or your older parents, depending on your age bracket, whatever they are doing is uncool. And whatever the West is doing is cool. So coffee consumption has nearly outpaced tea consumption in Japan. Obviously, beer in favor of sake is becoming more and more common. And so tea in Japan, and with RTD, the development of RTD in the 1970s, Japanese tea, in particular artisanal Japanese tea, has been in steady decline. And so coming back to what you were talking about matcha's popularity, that's really been kind of a godsend for the Japanese tea industry. And I say kind of because there's some complicating factors. Like, typically a factory in Japan would be set up for making loose leaf tea or making matcha. And there were not many who were doing both. But according to the market demands, a company such as Sugimoto Tea Company, we were doing basically exclusively loose leaf teas up until the 2000s, probably about 2010. And then as matcha slowly began to rise in popularity, we shifted to making matcha. And boy, our exports of matcha from Japan have gone from where I started. In 2013, we were doing maybe 100 kilos exporting of matcha a year, maybe probably less than that, to now doing like upwards of 100 tons of matcha that are being produced and exported. That's like about 1,000-fold increase in matcha that we've been producing and moving. So obviously that's helping a lot of Japanese farmers, particularly those who had the forethought or foresight to switch to organic farming methods. But the farmers who are making the more traditional artisanal loose leaf teas, like higher end senchas or gyokuro, they were still struggling and continue to struggle. But that's something that we're also kind of tackling and offering more varieties of specialty grades of sencha and gyokuro. I implemented the single cultivar series where we showcase one given cultivar and process it as a sencha. And we kind of cycle through about 3 or 4 different cultivars per year. I introduced that in 2018. And now we're trying to also showcase some of the other types of tea that are not as common but produced in Japan, like Japanese oolong, Wakocha, the Japanese black tea, and pan-fired green tea, Kamaibicha. So, yeah, there's a lot of artisanal teas still being made in Japan, and hopefully with increased interest from the foreign markets, those farmers are going to continue to make basically works of art with their tea.
What's the next big thing in Japanese tea? I'm primarily thinking of teas exported to the West.
And before I talk about the other teas, even within matcha, I would say we've seen a giant shift. But the demand was mostly for the more economical grades of matcha, like, you know, the lowest of the culinary grades. As much as we tried promoting the finer ceremonial grades, the demand was really for the cheaper stuff. And I've seen a big shift in the last 10 years where there's a lot more demand for the ceremonial grades now. And also people who might have been purchasing our most economical culinary in the past, stepping up a grade just to offer a better product. What might be the next big thing, or what might be the next trend in Japanese tea? Within Japan, I think Hojicha, the roasted green tea, is moving into a limelight. And whether that's going to be a limelight that's going to last, you know, for minutes on the economical timeline, or if it's going to endure in the way that matcha has, is to be seen. But one nice thing about hojicha is that, well, one, it's very different from matcha. So a lot of people get turned off by Japanese teas because they're so green and people don't like the grassiness, the vegetalness, the bitterness that especially will be noticeable in more economical teas. So hojicha provides a great counterpoint to that. It's brown, not green, although it's still a green tea because of how it's processed. It's got that kind of roasty, toasty aroma that coffee would offer. Still, it's an aroma of tea, but you know, it goes well alongside coffee and chocolate and those kinds of roasted dark brown agricultural products. And a lot of makers mill the hojicha to make a hojicha powder, which you can then use in all the same applications that matcha would be used in, such as baking or making lattes, or sprinkling as a topping on desserts. So it has all the versatility of matcha, but a very distinctly different flavor that appeals to people who, you know, may find that green flavor of the more common Japanese teas off-putting.
Now, that's a good point.
Yeah, I think the palates of the East, particularly Japan, has become more in line with the West. And on the reverse side, I think palates of the West have become a little more in line with the palates of the East. I feel like there's been sort of this narrowing of the gap of what used to be like, oh, this appeals to the Japanese tastes, this appeals to American tastes. And now, especially the younger Japanese people are wanting things that are more mild, more sweet. Hojicha has been great filling that space because it lacks a lot of the catechins and has less caffeine, so therefore less bitterness, less astringency. And especially when prepared as a latte, as you can find in 7-Eleven and ready-to-drink cartons, and you can find in Starbucks in Japan, the hojicha latte is a really, really approachable beverage, especially if it's sweetened. So it's been gaining a lot of traction in Japan, and we've also been seeing it gain a bit of traction here in the U.S. The really grassy teas that became prevalent in Japan amongst Japanese tea industry have been on the decline.
Intrigued by what you heard in today's podcast? Would you like to learn more from our global network of Tea Biz journalists and tea experts? Remember to visit the Tea Biz website for more comprehensive coverage. That's www.t-biz.com. Thanks for listening. Farewell till next week.
Produced by Atavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.